Okay, hey everyone. We're here today to hopefully get a little bit of insight into product management interviewing. So I'm just going to get started right away. Feel free to stop me, interrupt me, ask questions at any time. I want this to be as useful for you as possible. And if it gets boring, like, you can get up and go, and I'll take that as a signal to like try to be more entertaining for the rest of the people. So quick background on me. I studied chemistry and physics undergrad. I did a little bit of computer science inside. I did a couple internships, Microsoft, a couple startups, etc. And then I joined Google out of college, working for 2 years in an associate product management rotational program, sort of geared towards new grads or new hires or people who didn't have a lot of product management experience beforehand. And then I moved over to Google X, which is an affiliate of Google under the Alphabet umbrella, working on Project Loon, providing stratospheric balloon internet to people in developing countries for 2 years. And most recently, I've actually left Alphabet, so now I'm doing the SF thing, doing my own startup. It's called Nino Finance. I encourage you to check it out, ninofinance.com. We're taking signups, so check it out. Okay, so quick agenda for the things I hope to cover today. Really quickly, we'll just go over what is product management. Hopefully, you already have a really good concept of this, because hopefully you want to be a product manager by coming here. We'll go over a couple of the skills that I think good product managers have. Talk about preparing for an interview, the actual interview itself, and then some additional resources that you can look at afterwards if you're still curious and want to get more information. And of course, there'll be more time for questions at the end if you don't get them now. Really quick before we get started, like, who here is already a product manager, or has a product manager, or was a product manager? Okay, cool. And who wants to be a product manager? Okay, cool. And everyone else here is just like chilling. Okay, cool. I guess we'll figure out what's going on. So what exactly is product management? Like, does anyone have a good definition of like what they think product management is or what a product manager does? Someone have to pull teeth? No one knows what product management is?
Managing product.
What's that?
Managing product.
Managing product. What is
the
that?
Life cycle, the whole life cycle of the product.
Managing the whole life cycle of the product.
Go to market and going out.
Figuring out the go-to-market and how to get the product out there, definitely. Those are all like really important parts of it. I sort of created this chart of how I think different people view product management. And I think the point of this is that basically different people have different perceptions of what product managers do, and it can vary a lot from one company to the next. And even within a given company, it can vary a lot. So sort of succinctly, I think that product managers are sort of the intersection of a couple different things, user experience, technology, and business. And this is really cool. This is sort of part of the reason why I got into product management, is because it's a very interdisciplinary role. And so it shows off that you can have skills in different elements of different parts of the business. In one line, I think a great product manager can channel the voice of the user. They can figure out what problems the user has, what pain points a user is experiencing, and figure out how to solve them and how to communicate them. And I found this quotation online. I think it really gets to the heart of what a product manager does. So a great product manager has the brain of an engineer. You're going to be thinking about logical problem solving and code if you're working on software stuff, and how to problem solve. The heart of a designer, really being empathetic towards what kind of problems a user is experiencing, the pain points that they have, and having the speech of a diplomat, because you're definitely going to be communicating your ideas, influencing people, trying to get leadership on your team, trying to get people to do what you want. So I think this encapsulates what you want to do as a product manager. Okay, so what kind of skills do you want as a product manager? I'm going to highlight a couple of different skills that I think good product managers have. There's, of course, a long list of them, and it will vary from one person to the next. Not necessarily going to be an all-star at every single one of these things, but the more of these skills that you can build up, the more of these skills that you can show off in an interview, the better off you'll be. And also, being really deep at certain skills here will also show off that, hey, I can really understand product vision, or I have really good execution skills, whatever it may be. So I could go on and on about all these different areas, but I'm going to try to deep dive into a few of them just to give you some examples of where I thought either this was done really well or really poorly. So one example for user focus. So user focus, like being focused on the user, like understanding the user's problems. But the example here is for SoundCloud. Does anyone here work for SoundCloud? or how to bring to SoundCloud. Great, great. Hopefully no one from SoundCloud is watching this YouTube live stream. So there's this example of this user who goes onto the SoundCloud forums. This is from, I think, 2 years ago, and basically is asking, hey, I've been using SoundCloud, listening to music, and I noticed that there isn't any volume control. Like, is this an oversight, or what's going on? Is this a bug? And basically, if you keep reading the thread, there's a response from someone on the SoundCloud team who says, hey, we looked at this feature and we decided we're not going to implement it right now because we have other features to implement and it's not the top of our stack. And then like 20 other people post on this forum that has like over 10,000 views, and they're all saying, what the heck, like Pandora has volume control, like Spotify has volume control, like iTunes has volume control, Last.fm has volume control, like, everyone has volume control. Why does this product not have volume control? And I think SoundCloud is running into like a lot of trouble now, and for other reasons too, like they had some IP issues and stuff. But it just goes to show when you have like these really passionate users who are yelling at you about what feature they want, and like everyone else is doing this has this feature, it might be worth listening to what they're saying. So I like this example for that reason. Design sense. So this is an example that I've seen thrown out a bunch of times. So you have your standard pass, your boarding pass here with like a bunch of numbers and. They're like kind of all over the page, and then there's like scribbles all over it, and you have like barcodes in different places and stuff. And it's kind of been like this forever, and like kind of every airline kind of does sort of the same thing. It's not necessarily super easy to read. So various designers on the internet, I pulled one here from this guy, Peter Smart, you can check it out, sort of re-laid out the boarding pass in a sort of intuitive, clean design. It's really aesthetically pleasing, it's really easy to scan, and what I think is really interesting is it's really easy to fit into a passport, which is like a really nice design thing to think about. So when you're designing things, it's part about making it aesthetically pleasing and nicely laid out, but it's also thinking about like, hey, what is the actual use case? Like, how can I rethink even like the layout of how this might even work altogether? So I like this example for that reason. And a third example is entrepreneurial spirit. So especially if you're applying to bigger companies, if they tell you that, hey, we're a startup, Google, oh, our team's like a startup, it's like, that's total BS. Like, Google is not like a startup. If it's a smaller team, like maybe it'll be more startup-y, but it's not gonna be like a startup. But it can still give you an edge if you can bring some entrepreneurial spirit and enthusiasm and energy to an interview. And I don't mean like memorizing like Kanban or like Agile or like buzzwords, whatever. I mean like actually just being really excited and like willing to do things that are not scalable and trying to get your hands dirty, doing the simplest possible thing. Those kind of entrepreneurial spirit that you can show. So two quick examples. Some of these are pretty popular, so you may have heard of these, but basically on your left side here, there's basically these two cereal boxes created by some of the early folks at Airbnb. Like, they were being serial entrepreneurs, and this is like at a time when they were running really low on cash, and like they didn't really know what they were doing, and it was a really hard time for them. But the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, was going on, I believe, at the time. And so they came up with this idea that they were going to like sell cereal. Airbnb was going to sell cereal. So like they ordered 1,000 cereal boxes, literally manually folded the cardboard boxes, made these two brands of cereal for McCain and Obama, and sold them as collector's items for, I think, like around $50 each, and then raised $50,000 like doing this. So I thought it was an interesting way of these people getting their hands dirty and just like doing whatever needed to be done in order to keep the business alive. And then on the right side here, this is PaloAltoDelivery.com, which was the first version of DoorDash. Basically, Stanford students wanted to do food delivery, but they weren't sure if people were going to pay for it or if it was going to be a thing. So they basically threw up this landing page. They made it in a few hours. They put their like personal cell phone number, I think, on the middle of the page, and they're like, well, see if anyone uses this. And like, lo and behold, like, a person calls and says, like, I want to get some delivery. And the next day, like, three people call. And the next day, like, more people are calling. And then, like, suddenly they have a business. And they did this in a day, in, like, a few hours, without spending thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars doing market research or building out a logistical delivery network or anything. So just really validating an idea really quickly. So that's another cool example of this. Okay, a couple things that you should try not to do or try to avoid doing. First of all, product managers that are really good are going to lead by influence, not by authority. So you're not going to say, like, I'm the boss, and like, you guys all report to me, so you do what I say. Like, that's never going to work. Unless you're like a super senior product manager, you're probably going to be working with a team of engineers who don't report to you. And so you need to convince them that your ideas are really good, not boss them around and tell them they have to follow, do what you say. Also, having a really clear goal of what you're trying to build is super important. So you should always take into account what data you have and what user feedback you're getting and change your product to match those things. But you need to have a clear vision of what it is that you're trying to achieve ahead of time. And if you don't have that, then the people who are working day to day on different features, engineers, designers, whoever it may be, will feel a lot of whiplash if you're always changing. Like, okay, today we're doing this, tomorrow we're doing this other thing, okay, we're gonna change the scope again. So you need to have a clear North Star. What is the goal that we're trying to achieve? And then lastly, you can never blame someone else if something's wrong with your product. If you're the product manager, you own the product. When things go well, great job. Like, engineers deliver the features, designers design whatever, testers test the feature, it's great. When things go wrong, it's your fault. Even if the engineer introduced a bug or the designer had like some design flaw, whatever, like, it's your fault. You own the end-to-end product and you need to go figure out what's wrong and how to fix it. And if you can't fix it, you need to find the person who can fix it and have them fix it. So no blaming anyone else. That's a bad product manager. Okay, now actually getting towards the interview itself. Again, I put this here because it's your responsibility to research everyone you're going to be talking to, figure out who they are, what their background is, where they went to school, what their hobbies are, what team they work on. You try to get as much information as you can. There's really no excuse not to. And it will help you frame the conversation, maybe connect with the interviewer on some level, whether it be socially or academically or, you know, in the workplace. And if you don't know who they are, like, ask the recruiter and just try to get as much information as you can. Okay. So going into the interview, first thing you want to do is make sure your resume is up to date. Many of you have probably already done this or are in the process of doing this. So one thing is emphasize your previous PM experience. If you've already been a product manager, that's great. Like, pretty easy to do. Talk about the previous PM roles you had. Customize your resume for the places that you're applying. But if you haven't been a product manager, all hope is not lost. You can still emphasize the product management skills that you've developed in whatever other roles you've been working on. So if you were an engineer or a designer or a tester or marketing, whatever it was, you've probably still done some of the things that we talked about earlier, whether it's have a design sense or be execution or demonstrate leadership skills or whatever it may be. So just emphasize those things that you've done in your resume in whatever role it may be. Highlight the impact and make it quantitative. Like, I've seen so many resumes where people like don't have really solid numbers saying like the ROI I generated was 1,000x like user growth or like $45 million extra dollars were generated or whatever. Like, make sure there are numbers that are quantitative about what you achieved. One page. No more than one page. Resume is one page only. And a resume only matters to get your foot into the door. Your resume is going to get you an interview. An interview is going to get you a job. Resume is not going to get you a job unless you're like Larry Page or someone. So use the resume to get you the job, but don't expect you to get it. Use the resume to get you an interview. Don't expect you to get your job. And then lastly, like, a lot of people have different resume templates. You can look them up online. There's a million of them on Reddit. If you want, I've linked my own resume template here. You can click on this link when the presentation is made available, and there's a template which you can basically make a copy of and edit however you want. Okay, next thing. Think about where you're applying. In general, I encourage people to apply broadly. It's great to have a wide net, and it depends on how much time you have, but in general, it's great to cast a wide net. Here's a graphic of one dimension to think about. There are many dimensions to think about: location, size of company, industry, whatever else that you might care about. But here's one graphic that I like. It comes from a McKinsey report where they compare different kinds of companies on sort of how technical versus how businessy sort of the general product manager is at those companies. And it's just one graphic. You know, don't take this as like written in stone, letter of the law, but it gives you a sense that some roles are going to be way more technical if you're working on developer tools, back-end B2B tools at a certain company, versus if you're working on a very consumer-y or very business-y type of thing. So just keep that in mind when you're applying to different companies. Okay, now you have created an awesome resume, you've applied to all these companies, everyone wants to interview you because you're such a hotshot, and it's time to get researching. So for every single company where you're planning on interviewing, you want to make sure that you research at least all of these things. So you should definitely know the full product suite of the company. It doesn't mean you have to be an expert on every single thing they do. But like, let's say you're interviewing at Google. Google does a ton of different things. Like, they do search, they do ads, they do YouTube, they do VR, they do cloud, they do communication apps, like, you name it, they probably do it. So just make sure you understand sort of the breadth of what kind of things this company is doing, because those are all kinds of things that an interviewer might expect you to know or you might be asked about. Make sure you know the competitors, like what other companies are doing things in this space, or what companies are the leaders of this company that you're interviewing at worried about. Think about the customers, what they think about the company, and what kind of market share this company has. Like, is it an incumbent that is dominating, or is it like a newer startup that's trying to disrupt a larger industry? Think about those kinds of things. The high level revenue and scale, like, is it profitable? Is it generating hundreds of thousands of dollars, billions of dollars? Is it a 10-person company or like a 70,000-person company? All things that will change completely the working culture that you'll be in. The mission and the goal. This is probably the most important of all of these things. It's super critical that you understand the North Star of this company. Why do they exist? What are they trying to do? It's important for you on a personal level, so you understand if it's something that resonates with you and you're excited about. But it's also important because in the interviews, if you can connect your answers back to the mission and the goal, that is like cherry on top, and like that will set you aside from some other people who don't make those connections. So think about the metrics that the company cares about. Like, is it worried more about monetizing, growth, adding more users, or converting the users to have higher retention, or whatever it may be? Depending on what they care about, they're going to be focusing on different things. And again, you can tie those things that they care about back into the answers if they ask you about their own company. And then lastly, like, ask about leadership, or do some online research and figure out who the leaders are. Just for your own knowledge, like I once interviewed at Microsoft, and so one of the interviewers was like saying something about Paul Allen, and I was like, "Oh, Paul, like, I don't know who's that." And I think the interviewer like literally faceplant like in the actual interview. So they ask you about a co-founder of the company. Make sure you know who it is. Next thing, you should definitely be reading about the industry that you're working in. So this is generally geared towards software, technology, startups, and big, larger tech companies. It might be slightly different if you're in a different industry, but make sure you're reading about the industry and what's going on. This is a smattering of different blogs that might be relevant. I particularly like TechMeme because it has a really nice UI and it ranks things really well and clusters them really well, but make sure you're up to date on what the latest news is, because it's going to be relevant to probably whatever you're working on, or at least it's things that you can talk about in your interview or be knowledgeable about. Definitely build this into your daily habit. Pick your favorite blogs, whether it's these ones or other ones, and read it at least once a day. Every day starting from today till whenever your interview is. Okay, the actual interview itself. So now we're talking a little bit about the timeline of the interview and then different kinds of questions that you might be expected to receive and how to respond to them. So this is a very generic timeline that I've invented out of a mashup of different experiences I've had at various startups and larger companies, and it's going to vary from one company to the next, but it gives you a general sense in case you haven't been at a PM interview before, or if you've had experience at one company and wondering what it might be like at another one. So next, kind of small, I'll kind of talk through it. Step zero, not pictured here, is usually you'll submit your resume and probably talk to a recruiter, and they'll like ask you some demographic questions or whatever about where you live and some projects that you worked on. But then, assuming that goes well, step one is a phone interview usually. That's probably gonna be around 45 minutes, probably with the junior or mid-level PM, and it'll probably follow roughly something like the light red horizontal timeline here, where you have a few minutes at the beginning, sort of some softball, get to know you questions, probably two larger, deeper, meatier questions that are around 15 to 20 minutes, and then a wrap up at the end where maybe you recap some things and maybe you'll have a chance to ask the interviewer some questions. So if that goes well, then you'll probably be invited on site, and you'll probably have around 3 to 5 interviews with product managers, probably ones that you'd be working with, or at a larger company, random product managers in the company, and perhaps a designer and or a software engineer, if it's a software company. Again, you'll probably follow a similar type of timeline, 45 minutes, a couple warm-up, a couple wrap-up, and then two or so meatier questions. If that goes well, there may be a take-home exercise. Different companies have different philosophies on this. For example, Google and the Associate Product Management Program, there was a take-home communications writing exercise, sort of evaluating how good of a writer you are. At Stripe, they have a data analysis exercise. Some companies think this is a waste of time and don't do this, so it'll vary from one to the next, but just be prepared in case it comes up. And then usually there's a final round where you'll go back on site and talk to a couple more senior people, maybe your manager, maybe the head of product management, maybe a CEO at a smaller company, maybe a head of software engineering, etc. And then hopefully all goes well, you have an offer, and great, time to party. So what are the actual questions? Like, there's a ton of different kinds of questions, and you've probably experienced these if you've been a product manager or been in a product management interview before. But I've bucketed them into five larger categories. Again, it will vary from company to company, and some will be more or less emphasized depending on where you're applying. But in general, I think these are five sort of reasonable categories that you should definitely be super familiar with if you're applying for product management roles. So we'll go through each of them, and I'll give you example questions for each of these categories. First, product design, product vision. 100% should be getting this. If someone isn't asking you product design, product vision questions, you should question whether you should be working at this company. So here are some example questions. I'll let you read them. But in general, I think the question that you should be prepared for is, how should you design X for Y? Where X is a type of product or good or service, and Y is a type of user. So to give you a concrete example, I wrote one here. How would you build a bookcase for the elderly? So in this case, bookcase is the X, elderly is the Y. And what some people do who are newer to product management interviews or who are a little bit less experienced is they start thinking about the bookcase, the X, and they start thinking, okay, cool, bookcase, like we're gonna make it smartphone enabled, and we're gonna build an app, and it's gonna be great, and it's gonna be IoT, and we're gonna put Bitcoin in it, it's gonna be so awesome. The key thing to keep in mind here is back to what we said earlier. It's about channeling the voice of the user and being empathetic towards the user. So the key thing is thinking about why first. What's important here is not the bookcase. What's important is understanding your user, the elderly in this case. What kind of pain points is an elderly person gonna have? What kind of unique challenges might they face that the general population might not care about as much? So if you start thinking about those things and start talking about those things first, it'll help frame your mindset and the discussion with the interviewer better for figuring out what solutions you should lead to. So work through it backwards. Don't try to start with the solution. Another thing is, if you're interviewing, you should definitely feel excited about jumping up to a whiteboard. I found this to be really helpful myself, and I think it's a good way of showing how excited you are. And even if you're doing an interview on a video conference, some companies do this, like Facebook, for example, I think now has streamlined their interview process, and they do two video conference interviews rather than doing it on-site to save time and money. You can position yourself in a room where there's a whiteboard right behind you, and you can be like, hey, interviewer, like, do you mind if I jump up on the whiteboard? And they'll probably say, yes, that's awesome. You can start drawing things. So definitely be excited about using whiteboards. Be goals and metrics focused. So a lot of these questions have a million different ways of answering them. Like, how would you improve YouTube? Okay, YouTube has like billions of users, and there's like a million different things you could do to make YouTube better. So the key here is not to just like rattle off random things you do with YouTube. It's like, have a discussion with the interviewer. Okay, what's the goal here? Are we like trying to make it have more users, more retention, more monetization? Maybe the interviewer will give you an answer, or maybe they'll say, why don't you pick a goal? And then you can be really intelligent and say, well, I could optimize for any of these goals, but I'm gonna pick monetization because I think it's really important for YouTube to start monetizing more. And then you say, with that assumption in mind, the metric that I would care most about is the amount of revenue and profit I'm bringing in, and maybe the amount of revenue per user. And in order to optimize that, here are the features that would be really interesting. So now you've created a framework, you've laid out your assumptions, you've started answering why you're going to start building those features and why it ties back to the goal and the metrics. And again, if you can tie that back to the goal and the metrics that the company at large cares about, then you're, again, going above and beyond what some other people might do, which is awesome. And then the other good thing about that is you can be data-driven in your decisioning. So that means instead of saying, I'm so awesome, my ideas are so great, and my ideas are better than yours, I'm like, here's what you should do. You're saying, hey, look, we all agreed on the goal. This was the assumption. And now let's look at the data. Well, the data says like the metrics that matter are these things for this goal. And so therefore, we're going to build whatever features optimize these metrics the most. And now you've made the discussion like a scientific, logical discussion about the data rather than a my ideas are so awesome discussion, which is way more opinionated. And the last thing, this is sort of my creative twist on this thing. I basically think you should think really big and be a little crazy in your interview. And what I mean by this is, this interviewer has probably talked to 100, maybe 1,000 people about how they would improve YouTube. So if you say like the really good answer about making YouTube better, probably like hundreds of other people have said that answer too. So what will set you apart is saying something that's like a little bit crazy and like maybe a little bit innovative, but like maybe a little bit just like, wow, that's so crazy. Like, would we really do that? Like, I don't know. But it's the kind of answer that the interviewer is going to like go to lunch with and tell all of her friends. Like, oh, I had this crazy interviewee today who was like talking about doing this crazy thing. Those are the kind of answers you want. And there's this anecdote internally that circled around with the Google product managers where there's this interview question. I don't think people ask it anymore. It's like, list as many things as you can that you would do with the traffic cone. It's like, what a weird question. So the interviewees that are pretty bad will usually be like, oh, like I'd put it on the street to mark where cars can and can't go, like as a traffic cone. Okay, that's the worst answer ever. People who are kind of okay will be like, oh, I'd use it as a traffic cone, and like I'd use it to cover manholes, and like maybe I'd use it as like a weapon, and maybe I'd use it like as an ice cream holder. And the really exceptional ones are the ones where you like, can't get the interviewee to shut up. And like, oh, I'm going to use it for this, I'm going to use it as a hat, and I'm going to use it to roll down the hill, and I'm going to use it to like sit on as a chair, and I'm going to use it like, you know, to whack my roommate, and like whatever. Like, they just keep going on and on. You're like, okay, shut up, like I get it. Can you use a lot of things to the traffic cone? So again, it's like, just think creative, think bold, think about the things that like other you wouldn't expect some other random person to say that will keep you in the mind of the interviewer. Okay, second category, analytical. These kind of questions are, there's a lot of variety of them. A bunch of examples here. A lot of them are in the format of estimation questions or Fermi questions. You may be familiar with these. It's basically, how do you estimate this ridiculous quantity that you possibly, like, never possibly could know? Like, how much pizza is being made in Italy between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m.? It's like, I have no idea. The interviewer has no idea, you have no idea, and the point of the question is not to get the right answer. The point of the question is to come up with a reasonable set of assumptions, do some math, and come up with a reasonable estimate. And when I first heard about these questions, I'm like, this is absolutely ridiculous. This is so stupid. Like, how does this have anything to do with product management or my future career? What I've realized over the time is actually there'll be a bunch of times where you'll have to do estimations as a product manager. So for example, let's say you're working on launching some new feature on Google Search. People are gonna ask you like how much memory you need, how much quota do you need, how much serving availability you need. So you need to estimate how many users are gonna make those search queries and how many times is it gonna trigger that search feature that you're launching so you can properly allocate resources for it. So doing kind of estimations like this are things that oftentimes do come up. So having a good framework for this is useful. If you've never done this before, there's a link in here, you can check it out. There's tons of examples online. You can Wikipedia estimation questions, and there's a bunch of different examples you can check out. But you should definitely just be good at making a reasonable set of assumptions, doing some mental math, coming to an answer. And again, it's not about getting the right answer, it's just about making reasonable assumptions and doing some reasonable math. Make sure you're familiar with launch metrics, A/B testing, experimentation. If you don't already know those concepts really well, make sure you look them up. You can integrate that into the answers that you come up with. And make sure you're like, okay, doing some mental math. You might be like estimating the number of households in the United States or the number of cars sold every year, things like that. So you should be able to come up with reasonable estimates of what the population is, divided by the number of households, divided by the number of cars a household has, that kind of basic math. Are there any questions about this kind of category of questions? Yeah, go ahead.
So would it be okay, like, for example, you just said estimate how many households there are in the U.S. Would it accept one to be like, hey, I go to this resource where you can find out that there's this amount of households in the U.S. and cite that resource?
Okay, so the question is, would it be a reasonable answer for estimating the number of households to, like, say I'm going to go to XYZ source and, like, cite the number of households from that source? I would not recommend doing that. Because again, the point is not to get a perfect answer. The point of this is to come up with a reasonable set of assumptions and work through some logic. So instead, what I would say is, I don't know the exact number of households, but let's say the population of the United States is approximately 300 million. Like, let's round it up and say that that's true. And let's say the average household size, well, I'm not exactly sure, but let's say the average household size is two people. So we're gonna divide 300 million by two and say there's 150 million households. I would just say come up with a reasonable estimate and just say it's an assumption. I'm not sure if it's 100% right, but that's what I'm gonna assume and move on. Yeah, go ahead.
So basically, like, if you have like a question for the other person, like that might help you with your assumption of like, would you be able to ask that, or would you, or is it better to just say like, I don't actually know, but I think it's around this amount based on XYZ, or is it better to ask this?
So the question question is, how collaborative is the interview? Should you just make assumptions, or should you ask the interviewer if you don't know for clarity? Deb, you definitely have to read the situation and figure out what the dynamic is with the interviewer, but in general, I think that you should never talk for more than 2 minutes without engaging the interviewer. It's definitely a discussion, and it's not a monologue. Like, when I've done interviews in the past at Google and other places, if someone talks for more than 5 minutes, I'm like, oh my God, please stop talking. Like, this is... And then, like, one time someone went on for 15 minutes, I was like, this is over. Like, this interview is done. Like, this is not going to happen. So I always encourage people to ask questions when they don't know. If an interviewer is clearly getting annoyed that you keep asking too many questions, then, like, you know, you can lay back a little bit. But in general, just be like, hey, I'm not exactly sure. Is there a number you had in mind? And if they say, like, no, just come with a reasonable estimate, just go with that. I think for certain basic things, like estimating households or populations and things like that, you should feel comfortable coming up with reasonable estimates. But as you get into more details, especially with some of the other strategy questions, which we'll talk about in a minute, it's totally reasonable to say, hey, hold on a second, what's the goal here? What are we trying to optimize for? And let them guide you. And if they say, you pick your own goal, then you have the leeway to do that. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going. So 3, behavior and execution. These can vary, again, depending on if they're more behavioral or more execution focused, but a lot of them are about your past experiences. Tell me about a time when you had a fight with a designer and the designer changed your mind. Or tell me about a time when you failed and what did you learn and what was the challenging thing that happened. Or what are you most proud of? Whatever it may be. So one important thing here is to tell stories. Don't talk at the interviewer. Like, try to be engaging. Try to talk about something exciting. Be animated. Be excited about your own story. And be concise. Again, if you're talking for more than 2 minutes, maybe 3 minutes, then you're talking too much. Stop, evaluate, see, read the interviewer. Are they excited? Are they listening? Are their eyes glazed over? Ask them questions. Have them be engaged too. And also sell yourself. The whole point of the interview is for the person to see you in your best self and for them to be really excited about how awesome you are. So make sure your stories are really exciting and emphasize how you got stuff done or you were in this crazy situation and you overcame this challenge and it was so awesome. Make sure you sell yourself. And then the cherry on top thing we talked about earlier, if you can make your answers tie back to the company, the mission, the culture, the values, then you're doing more than other people are doing. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you give a brief example for those, please?
For one of these questions?
Yeah.
Okay, so for example, someone asked me, like, tell me about a time when you overcame a challenge. So one story I like to tell is when I was working on Project Loon. So Project Loon, for those of you who don't know, is basically a project where we're providing internet access with these high altitude balloons. So it's like taking a cell tower, putting on a balloon in the stratosphere and beaming down internet access. So one of the projects I was working on was based in Peru, and I don't know any Spanish, and they shipped me off to Peru, and I had to go talk to a local telco provider to integrate our stack with the local telco stack. So kind of walking along to this telco provider's office, and it's 4:59 p.m., and I didn't know this, but the office closes at 5. So I'm walking into the office, as I'm walking in, the security guard is like closing the door and like dropping this huge lock on the door. And I'm like, oh my God, like, I am getting into this place before this guy locks the door. So like running in and he's like yelling at me in Spanish, like I have no idea what you're saying. But I'm like, I came here all the way from California, like you are not locking me out of this door. So he's like, I'm just like fighting this guy, like yelling at him, he's yelling at me, and like neither one of us knows what the other person is saying. But I'm like, finally get my way in there. And then the manager is like, no, you have to leave, like we're closing. I was like, no, I'm not leaving until I talk to someone and like get this thing resolved. And the situation went on and on. It got like more and more ridiculous. But the point of the story was like, I was just like super vehemently dedicated to like getting this issue resolved and getting this bug fixed before leaving that day. And the fact that they saw me kind of being like, this kid is not going to leave until we resolve this problem, so we might as well resolve it, ended up leading to us getting all of our issues fixed that day. So that was sort of an example I would tell if someone asked me about a time where I showed perseverance. That's kind of a crazy story. Even if you don't have like some crazy story about like yelling at people in Spanish, just think about something that you did and just try to make it exciting or just show that you were excited about what you achieved or what you did. Yeah, go ahead.
So these types of questions are notorious for including negative things. Tell me when you fail. Tell me you're a weak suit. Something like that. My question for you is: no matter how much they actually say they want to hear that stuff, should you, as an interviewer or interviewee, really give it to them? Should you pivot? Should you actually give them that information?
Okay, so the question is basically, like, some of these questions are asking about negative things, like about the time you failed or the time you did something wrong. Should you really give it to the interviewer, or like should you try to put like maybe answer something different or give a spin on it? So if you had this like catastrophic failure where you like screwed something up so badly and like it destroyed your company or something, I'd maybe leave that one out. But in general, I would say like try to be authentic. People are pretty good at like reading emotions, and like if you're trying to like be too slick or too sly about something, usually people can tell. But try to put like some positive thing that you learned or like the challenge that you overcame. Like if you fail, it's totally fine. Like it's, if you haven't failed, that's a red flag for me as an interviewer. Like you've never done anything wrong, then you've never like tried to do something beyond your skill set. So like failing is totally fine, but talk about what you learned or talk about like what you're going to do better next time. So like try to put some positives on it, but I think it's okay to talk about when things have gone wrong. Like everyone has done things when things went wrong. That's my two cents. Yeah. Okay, so let's keep going here. Okay, the all-dreaded technical section. So if you're coming from like a software engineering background or something, then this project section will be super easy for you. These questions will probably be way easier than normal software engineering questions that you would get. If you're not coming from a technical background, then like this may be super dreaded. So remember, I did not study computer science. I like did chemistry and physics, and like I took like some of random computer science classes at the end of my college career. So I would not classify myself as like highly competent technically when I was applying to Google. Nonetheless, somehow snuck through. So here's how you do it. First of all, you get lucky because there is a large variation in the types of technical questions you may get. Some companies like may not care at all if you're technical, and other companies may want you to be really detailed in your technical skills. So these questions can vary from describe like deep learning to a five-year-old. That's a good example. Like explain technical concept to a five-year-old. I really like that question because it makes sure that you can actually understand what the concept is and you can actually boil it down to the things that matter rather than using random buzzwords. On the other hand, sometimes you'll talk to a really eager software engineer who wants to know like how good you are at coding in Python or whatever, and ask you to go up to a whiteboard and like start writing out an algorithm. And if you like know what you're doing, like, you might start sweating at this point. So the things you can do to prepare on that. One, brush up on your data structure and algorithms class if you ever took one in college. If you didn't take one in college, like try to find some online resource. Go to product schools, coding for managers class, go online, go to Khan Academy, go find some website or some tutorial that talks about different data structures, algorithms, and just teach yourself the basics. You don't need to be a super, super expert necessarily to be able to understand what's going on here, at least to a product management level. Second thing, if you get asked a coding question, go up to a whiteboard and write out pseudocode first. Don't try to start answering the coding question with code unless you're super confident and you know exactly what you're doing. That way, you can lay out what you would be doing in sort of theory or in concept, and then you can hash that out into code afterwards. So if you stumble on the actual coding part, it won't matter because you've already won more than half the battle by showing you understand the technical parts that matter and how they work together. So for example, if someone asks you to write an algorithm that detects meeting conflicts, you're like, shoot, I have no idea how to do that. Okay, go up the whiteboard. Okay, meeting conflicts. Meeting conflicts means there's going to be different people, so we're going to have to figure out which people are involved. And there's going to be time, so we're going to figure out like what times that there are. And maybe we'll make a table, and we'll figure out for each person what blocks of time they have meetings. And then we'll do some kind of merge and like figure out at any given time like what times that they're meeting. You know, you can kind of lay that out and then start coding it. And then by the time maybe the software engineer who's interviewing you might just be like, yeah, I get that you understand this. Like, let's move on. Maybe work to it to the end, but it's okay if you lay out the idea technically in a pseudocode sort of format. That's really a good starter rate. Okay, if you've ever built an app or a website or a project or anything that's remotely technical, have it ready to go. So I was super nervous for doing technical interviews at Google, but I had built this like web app in college that basically gave you directions to indoor buildings around campus. And it was really simple. I basically did some really basic thing, but it was something that required some like basic level of coding. So I basically loaded this app on my phone, had it ready to go on my phone, and like I was answering these technical questions and like butchering them, and like software engineers like, oh my god, like how did this guy get into this building? But then I was like, look, like, hey, I built this mobile app, check it out. And he's like playing around with the app, and he's like, okay, like, maybe he's not a complete idiot. So having something like that, it can tip the scales. So just have it ready to go just in case. Show off anything that you've done that is remotely technical. And then definitely ask your recruiter beforehand how technical the interview will be. And they might not give you a super straight answer, but try to get as much information as you can. Like, am I going to be interviewing with software engineers or product managers? Is there going to be coding? Am I going to have to like write actual code on the whiteboard, or is it going to be technical questions that aren't coding? Try to ask these things ahead of time so you can be as prepared as possible. Okay, and then lastly, strategy. So some companies will ask questions that are more businessy or strategic in nature, like should X acquire Y, or should this business get into the product XYZ? And a lot of these are sort of like case interview questions that you might see in like consulting interviews, like at McKinsey or Bain or BCG or whatever. And if you're not familiar with these, again, there's a ton of frameworks you can use. It's all about breaking the problem down into smaller chunks and addressing different parts of your assumptions and coming to a logical answer. If you want more practice with these, there's a great book called Case in Point by Mark Cosentino. You can read it. There's a ton of examples, a ton of frameworks. It's don't get overwhelmed and don't try to jump right to an answer. Try to start with, what are the goals? What is Apple trying to do? Okay, what are the metrics that they care about? Okay, what are a set of assumptions? Okay, let's think. Will this acquisition help achieve those metrics given these assumptions? Yes or no? And in my opinion, the worst thing you can do here is kind of come up with a wishy-washy answer. Like, oh, like, if they're interested in getting more into online video, then like maybe yeah, but if not, then like maybe not. Or a more detailed version of that. I think it's much better to really clearly say, here are my assumptions, here's my goal, and given this assumption and the set of goals, it does make sense, or it doesn't make sense, and make the argument. Just pick a side and make a compelling argument, because they're not evaluating you on whether you're strategically right. That's why Tim Cook is getting paid the big bucks. They're evaluating on whether you can answer the question in a logical way. And there's Porter's Five Forces. There's a bunch of other frameworks, so you can check them out. Yeah, go ahead.
So you mentioned, like, pick a side and kind of make a brief argument for that. Does that mean you shouldn't consider, like, trade-offs before that first? Or?
So the question is, I said pick a side. Does that mean you shouldn't consider the trade-offs? Like, definitely no. You should absolutely consider the trade-offs as part of your discussion. So, like, let's say you're doing the, like, should, let's just keep the same example. Should Apple build, or should Apple acquire Netflix? Like, okay, like, let's say the goal of Apple is to, like, capture as much user attention as possible with various services. And then you pick a reasonable set of assumptions and a reasonable set of metrics that they're optimizing for. You should absolutely walk through, okay, here are the pros and here are the cons. Like, okay, let's estimate the cost. Acquiring Netflix is going to cost, like, you know, X billion dollars. Okay, well, that's a huge opportunity cost. Apple could instead do all these other things with that money. They could build their own Netflix competitor. They could invest in music streaming instead of video streaming. They could do all these other things. So those are all the downsides. The upside is, well, they'll have all these engaged users, and they'll have all these monthly actives, and they'll have a competitive advantage against Amazon Prime and whatever. And then you definitely want to evaluate those in picking a side, but evaluate them and pick a side, as opposed to saying, well, there's pros and cons, so you could really go either way. That's what I mean. Okay, in general, things to do, things you should definitely do, questions to definitely expect. Tell me about yourself. This is a really easy warm-up question that people will ask you. Don't go on a monologue. 2 minutes or less, short and sweet, have it practiced, have it good enough that people are really excited about, like, oh yes, this person is really excited. This person is clearly like into product management. This person is clearly into the company I'm interviewing. Short and sweet. Why XYZ company? Don't say, oh, it's the hottest thing on TechCrunch right now. Pick a good reason, and especially if you can tie it back to goal and mission. That will be a good answer. Really easy softball question, nail it. Why are you switching roles? Sometimes people will ask you, why are you quitting Google to come work at Amazon? Or why are you leaving marketing to become a product manager? So focus on the positive things, not the negative things. So if your previous manager at Apple was like the worst person ever, don't just be like talking crap about your old manager. Focus on, well, I'm just really excited about this new opportunity and the new sets of challenges I'll face and whatever. This is a small community, people talk to each other, you never know who knows who. So focus on the positives. Why product management? Again, like, think about the reasons why it's important to you. Like, I really like interdisciplinary work, or I like working with engineers but not doing coding myself, or I like thinking about business problems and technical problems or whatever. Come up with a good, compelling, street sort answer. And then, absolutely, absolutely have an answer prepared for this series of questions. Tell me about your favorite product, app, service. Why do you love it? How would you make it better? How would you measure that? And have this answer prepared for 5 products so well that you know them on the back of your hand and you get some amazing answers. 5 products, everyone should have the answer for this. Yeah?
How okay is it to use a non-technical product?
How okay is it to use a non-technical product? In my opinion, I think it's better because it will show that you're thinking, again, uniquely and differently than most other people. It depends on the interviewer, though. Some interviewers will say, pick an app that's on your phone, or pick a software product. And so if they do that, then you want to have at least one or two examples that are software products. But I think it sets, I think it's creative and interesting to do a non-technical product. In fact, I've heard some interviewers say, force you to do a non-technical product to make people who have rehearsed for this too much think outside the box. For example, pick your favorite piece of furniture in your house. Let's use that as the product. So I think it's good, but just feel how it goes with the interviewer. Okay, be concise. Speak slowly, the opposite of what I'm doing right now. And then be friendly, smile, show excitement. Like, talking to an unexcited interviewee is the worst. You definitely want people who are engaged and excited and passionate and really interested in what's going on. So be excited. And then practice, and then practice, and then practice, and then continue practicing after that. and be confident, too. Even if you're really nervous, try to be confident. It makes you come across as more competent, even if you're not. Okay. Even though everyone's going to ignore this advice, on interview day, like, don't be cramming last-minute facts about Amazon's business model or whatever. Just relax. Walking in relaxed will make you more confident, and that will matter way more than any last-minute cramming that you're doing. Chill. And then after the interview, during the wrap-up section, there's usually a time for you to ask questions back to the interviewer. And this is the time when you want to ask really good questions. Because if you ask no questions or stupid questions, that reflects really badly on you and shows that you haven't actually spent any time thinking about this job or this company. So you want to ask questions like, is this going to be a good fit for me? So ask them, who's the manager? Does the manager have a good management style? If it is the manager, ask them what the management style is. How are you going to mentor me? What kinds of things am I going to learn? Ask about the cultural values. Don't ask about things that you can find on the company's website. And if you're talking to people who aren't your manager, ask them how great it is to work here. Ask them if they would send their kids to work here. Ask them about their favorite thing and least favorite thing about working at the company. Ask them what their plans are for their next job. Ask them whatever you can to evaluate whether you're going to be happy in that role. And then at the end, make sure to thank your interviewers with a follow-up email. Either try to get the email from the interviewers themselves. Sometimes they won't want to give it to you for privacy or confidentiality reasons or whatever. So ask the recruiter. If the recruiter doesn't want to give it to you, just email the recruiter and tell them to pass it on. And it'll show that, hey, you followed up. Better than that is if you can include something personal from the discussion you had. Let's say you talked about self-driving cars. Look up that cool new blog post that you saw explaining this cool new feature about how it's going to totally transform cities. Link it into your thank you note and say, like, hey, I was really thinking about this and it's so awesome. Or if you really butchered the question, you like had this awful answer, but then you like, oh shoot, I figured it out afterwards, then follow up and say, like, hey, I was really thinking about this all day or all night or whatever, and I also think all these other things would be really cool answers. And I actually did that during my phone screen at Google. One of the questions was, imagine you get hired at Google and Sergey Brin comes to you and says, you are working on teleportation, that's your product, and we've just teleported our first golf ball from one side of the campus to the other side of the campus. But like, we're really, really ready to scale this technology, and we want you to figure out how it's going to impact society in 20 years. I was like, okay, like, really? Like, that's what we're going to do? Okay. So I came up with some answers, and like, they weren't really well thought out, and I kind of said some generic stuff that you kind of expect people to say, and I could tell that the interviewer was kind of hoping for a little bit more. So I walked out there, and I was like, super demoralized. I got off the phone, and I was like, oh, God, that was such a bad answer. I like LinkedIn stalked the heck out of this guy, found his email, emailed him back, and I was like, that was a horrible answer. Here are like 10 other things I think would happen, and like, here's why I think they would happen. And I was like, didn't know if this was gonna be the real guy's email or his email from like middle school or whatever. But the next day, he emailed me back and he's like, thank you so much for following up. I really liked your follow-up answers. And I'm still in touch with that guy today. So I think that definitely made a difference. Okay, so if that, oh yeah, go ahead.
So if your interviewers won't give you their email address, how bad a thing would it be to like send a personal note by like the mail or something? Like, have their company's address,
yeah.
Or have their name.
Yeah.
Name, at company, address, Reno, California, 95014.
Yeah. So the question is, like, if you can't get the email address of the person who interviewed you, how bad is it to just send them like physical mail? I guess that's a fine last resort. But the timing on that probably isn't gonna work out super well. Usually people write feedback like the same day or the next day. So you can do that as a last resort. I would recommend trying to get the email. If you can't get the email, ask the recruiter for their email. If you still can't get their email that way, just email the recruiter. You'll definitely have someone's email at the company, and you can ask that person to forward your note to the interviewee. The interviewer. That's what I'd recommend. Okay, so practice makes perfect, and nobody's perfect. Why practice? Does anyone know the answer to this? Velociraptor book? Like, no one practices enough. That's why no one's perfect. So everyone should practice more. Okay. So if all this was not enough and you want to practice a ton more, then there's a bunch of other resources. You can search for them all over the internet. I'm sure many of you have already done that too. But here's some that I like. Practice PM Interview Questions is a website. Just keep hitting enter. It keeps reloading and keeps asking you more questions, and you keep practicing. What distinguishes the top 1% of PMs? This is an interesting Quora question and answer, and I think there's some really good answers. I think one of the directors at Airbnb posted some really good answers at the top there. If you want to talk to me, I have this like consultation page. You can click on it on eVisors. It's a platform where you can talk to me, or there's a bunch of other people on there too. And then if you want more frameworks for how to solve some of these problems and how to structure your answers, there's this thing called the Circles Method that you may be familiar with. If you're not, there's a book called Decode and Conquer by Lewis Lynn. It explains this whole framework in detail and gives you a bunch of examples on how you can break down these large, nebulous questions into concrete bites. Did someone have a question?
Hi, so how deep you should go and down to a writer's document to wrap up the document and the document itself? Because some interviews, it's pretty high level, the basic products you're doing, but in some interviews, they actually like to go in depth.
So the question is, in how much depth do you need to research the products or services of a company? Because it can vary a lot from company to company. It depends on which company you're interviewing for. At Google, typically, for example, they say don't ask interviewees questions about your products or expect them to know things about Google products in general, because having knowledge about a specific topic isn't useful for becoming a product manager. You're going to become familiar with it if you start working on it. Other companies will definitely ask you detailed questions, like you said. So evaluate where you're applying. Ask people you know at those companies, and also see if you. I mean, you want to go into some level of depth. You want to definitely know what the products are and understand how they work. But don't kill yourself over understanding every little detail. That's what I would say. It will vary from company to company. I would say generally larger companies it'll matter a little bit less, and at smaller companies it'll matter a little bit more. Okay. So that's my presentation. Open it up for more questions. Yes. Yes, yes.
I think Google's known for really valuing CS degrees for product managers. Can you say if that's still the case, just since you've been there, just kind of curious, and maybe other places that you know of think that a CS degree is required for PM or not?
Okay, the question is, she's heard that Google has been known for having product managers who have CS degrees. Is that true? Is it not? What about other places? Not speaking as an authority here, I only have like anecdotal experience based on the people I knew. I would say generally, out of my associate product management class of about 30 product managers coming out of college, probably like 90% of them had computer science undergrad degrees. I was an exception, and there were like maybe a few other exceptions, but everyone had some kind of technical degree, whether it be like science or math or whatever. Definitely not required. Like, some of the best product managers at Google are coming from totally non-technical backgrounds, studied econ or did like marketing or whatever. And there are lots of other great companies where there's really strong product managers who didn't have technical backgrounds. But especially places like Google, they really pride themselves on being very technical and engineering driven. So they sort of have this really skewed distribution. In general, I think it's kind of a weird requirement because you're not actually going to be doing coding day to day as a product manager at Google, probably, but they sort of do pride themselves on that. So definitely helps if you have it. If you don't, it's not the end of the world. I did it, and if I can do it, you probably can do it too. Just make sure you brush up on those like basic technical skills. Yeah, go ahead.
So I noticed it was a case interview part of the push of the interview. So I was kind of wondering, out of your friends formerly MVP who are now at different tech companies as product managers, so I was wondering, just out of curiosity, is there some sort of, do they actually target consulting people support product manager positions? Was it just coincidence?
Okay, so the question is, like, did there were some consulting questions? Did they target product, like, interview candidates from consulting backgrounds? I think they do sometimes. Like, for example, a lot of companies will target people who are coming out of their MBA and maybe, like, have previous consulting experience. It depends from company to company. And again, those questions will be, like, more prevalent from some companies and less prevalent in others. I think some tech companies do target ex-consultants, especially if they're more businessy, but not necessarily the case of all of them. And, oftentimes the case questions will have some, like, technical twist on them too. So, like, one set of questions that people sometimes like to ask at Google, for example, is they'll take some technical, like, database problem and then convert it into they'll disguise it as a case question that sounds businessy, but it's really just a technical problem that's disguised. So an example of that is, let's say you're the product manager of a Safeway grocery store that gets a certain number of users or customers every day. And then one day a week, it gets 10 times more users. So, like, every Tuesday you have a sale and, like, 100 people come instead of 10 people every other day. How would you take care of that situation? Or what would you do to your store to take it to, like, improve the user experience given that distribution of users? And so, like, I'm saying this kind of off the top of my head and not phrasing it super well, but basically if you think about it super, like, case-wise and super businessy, then you might miss out that this is actually just the same question as, like, traffic spiking on a certain website during certain times of day or during certain times of the weekend or whatever. And so sometimes the case questions at more technical companies will actually not just be a normal case question that you might get in a consulting interview, but also might have a technical or product component. So does it strictly answer your question? Depends. Some places will do it, some people won't. Yeah.
Do you recommend any either books or knowledge bases for how to actually do good product work? You mentioned evaluating matrices and then priorities. Are there, like, use cases of, like, this was done in the past, this was the right way to do it, this is the wrong way, best practices, or is it just kind of like voodoo secrets of the industry that people just go by trial and error? Because I know you guys hire super smart people, but there's got to be best practices that, you know, patterns that you guys use to solve big problems.
Yeah, so let me just clarify the question before I try to answer it. So are you asking for, are there best practices for being a product manager or for product manager interview questions?
No, the methodology is not the interview. The interview is just basically not filtering the dumb and the stupid from smart, but actually doing the work, you probably need a toolbox, or you got to rely on experience of, problems you looked at, best practices.
Okay, so the question is, what are the best practices for being a good product manager and building good products? And, like, is it a voodoo secret, or are there frameworks or guides for that? There are, like, tons of different guides and theories for this, and it definitely depends from person to person and what product you're working on. I definitely didn't have time to cover that today because it was mostly focused on interviewing, but if you're curious, we can talk more about it after. There's lots of blogs, like, a lot of product managers post different stories that they have. In general, like, the part that I covered here was know your user. Go spend time with your user. Talk to your user. Figure out their pain points, and all else will follow. But there's a lot more specifics and a lot more guidance depending on what you're trying to do. There's tons of resources out there. Talk to me after. Yeah, go ahead.
So I have a two-part question, and it's more about, related, it's more about not doing the interview, but getting the interview. In the research that I've done, for people trying to break into product management, to get those, like, associate PM roles, what I've mainly, almost exclusively, only seen people in interviews who are either coming right out of school, as you did, or making lateral moves within an organization. So my two questions for you are, number one, is that your observation also that these entry positions, for the most part, only go to those first two categories? And two, if so, what can someone who's not in those two categories do to increase the odds of getting the interview?
Okay, so the question is, for entry-level product management positions like the Associate Product Manager Program, is it mostly people who are coming straight out of college? Or are there also ways...
And lateral moves.
Or lateral moves within the company? Or are there ways that people who aren't doing those two things can get those positions, and, like, how can they improve their chances of getting those positions? So, again, this is anecdotal, but in my class of about 30 associate product managers, I would say probably around half to maybe a little bit more than half were coming straight out of undergrad or grad school, and maybe, like, a third to a half were coming from outside in different positions that were not making necessary lateral moves, but coming from other work experience or startups or whatever else. So there was definitely a more diverse mix than I think you sort of experienced or were implying in my class. It can be challenging making a move from an outside company that is either in a product management role or not product management role. It's definitely easier because a lot of these programs are geared towards new grads, and it's a lot easier when you're making a lateral move internally. But if you are external and you want to improve your chances, the best things I can think of are, again, like building those PM skills that we talked about, emphasizing those, and working on technical projects or products on your own time, whether it's an app, a website, a service, a club that you built, a small business that you started, something entrepreneurial that you did. Those kind of things that you can show off and say, like, hey, here's how I built my product skills by doing these things and showing those things off. Give you the best chance of getting those positions, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
This probably kind of relates to the previous question, but if you're already a PM in a specific industry, say like healthcare and medical devices, and you're trying to transition into a PM role in a different industry, like say e-commerce, consumer tech, how would you make yourself more competitive at a resume level as well as all the way through the interview process?
Okay, so the question is, like, if you're a PM already in one industry and you want to switch to being a PM in a different industry, how do you make yourself more competitive? So there's a bunch of different things you can do. One is on your resume, emphasize different kinds of diversity of things you've done. If every single PM position you've ever had is like in healthcare, then people will sort of start to peg you into the healthcare role. So you have control of your resume, right? Like, emphasize different things. And even if they're all healthcare companies, you can talk about non-healthcare parts of the project that you worked on. And when you talk to the recruiter or interviewers, you can emphasize that, like, I had a really good experience in healthcare and I'm really excited about taking on a new challenge, doing something else. You can emphasize side projects that you've worked on. You can try building an e-commerce website, or you can try showing like some side project that you've worked on related to e-commerce or whatever other industry that you're excited about, and emphasize that as well. So I'd say side projects, emphasizing things on your resume, and then just making it clear when you talk to people. It's easy to get pegged into a hole, but be clear up front. Like, I'm really excited about XYZ industry and here's why. Yeah, go ahead. Can I go on? Sorry, my startup is super awesome. You should definitely check it out, neofinance.com. I don't want to like distract with people who don't care though, so if you're curious, come talk to me or check out neofinance.com. Sign up, there's an email list, I'll send you more information.
You
it's a fintech.
Website,
what's that?
Can't find a website. Can you just send us more?
What's that?
I can't find a website.
You can't find a website. Neofinance.com, it's not working.
Oh, you need to check it.
It's down already.
How do you spell it?
N-I-N-O. finance.com. Check it out, put your email in, send you more information. Yes?
As an interviewer, what would you weigh the most? So like the user experience, the technical, or the business side? I know you drew a diagram at the beginning.
Okay, so one thing I forgot to sort of emphasize in the beginning of this, this will vary a lot from company to company, but the way that interview decisions are actually made, especially at a company like Google, is that each interviewer will have one hat that they wear. So like one interviewer will be interviewing you for analytical, one will be interviewing you for product vision, one will be interviewing you for execution, and like maybe an engineer will be interviewing you for technical. So each person is sort of trying to evaluate you on one category of things, and then they'll write feedback. All that feedback is then aggregated and sent to a different group of people who are on hiring committee. Those people haven't actually met you or interviewed you. And this is meant to prevent like decreased bias and have a more objective evaluation of each candidate. And the hiring committee sort of evaluates how well you're doing on each of these things. And at a competitive company, like when you're talking about some of these top companies, you really have to do pretty well on all of them. So any individual person is probably evaluating on one, maybe two of these criteria, but the hiring committee is going to want to make sure that you're at least at a certain high bar on all of these things. If you really stand out at one thing, it can help sort of mitigate doing a little bit poorly on another one. Definitely that's the case for me in my technical interview. Something else saved me. It wasn't technical skills. But in general, you want to do really well because the people evaluating you aren't going to be just from your one interview. They're going to be from looking at your whole packet as a whole. Yeah. And the one other thing I'll say is it depends on the role. Like if you're interviewing for a very specific role, like I'm interviewing for being the product manager on like Google Hangouts front-end UI, then they're definitely going to care more about your design skills than whatever else. But if you're interviewing for a general PM role, which is going to be the case if you're interviewing at a big company like Facebook or Google, then it's going to be all the skills are generally important, I think. Yeah, go ahead and back.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to how to get an internal referral for a job and for getting an interview.
Okay, how do you get an internal referral? Okay, super critical. I didn't mention this either. If you know anyone, or you know anyone who knows anyone at a company you're applying, definitely have them refer you. Having an internal referral will put you like way ahead of someone randomly cold applying. How do you get an internal referral? Well, if you know people, super easy. You just email them, be like, hey, here's my resume. I'm really excited about product management. I want to get this position. Can you refer me? The tricky thing is if you don't know people or you don't know them super well, or you know people who maybe know people but you're not really sure. So some like easy tools to do that, check that, are you can go on LinkedIn, you can look at your second degree connections and your third degree connections and see if anyone you know is connected to anyone you know at that company. You should do that for every single company, and then everyone you're comfortable messaging that's in your first degree connection set of network, email them and say, hey, do you know this person? Can you intro me? I'd love to talk to them. And to have a phone call, have a casual conversation with them. Just be like, hey, I want to learn more about product management roles at your company. Do you have time to chat? And a lot of times people are just willing to talk to a random stranger. I've certainly done that a number of times for random people. So just get to chat with them, talk to them, explain what you're doing and why you're excited. And at the end, sometimes you can even ask, like, hey, would you be willing to refer me? Or just kind of casually bring that up. So that's one way. And then use your network, basically, is the summary. If you don't have a good network, then put yourself in an environment where you'll meet new people and build up your network, whether that's going to school or going to product school type of thing, or going to formal education or doing a startup or joining another company or whatever it may be. Put yourself in situations where you'll meet new people and grow your network. Yeah. Yeah.
Not to cheat the system, just trying to help everyone else, but who is known to have the easiest interview process?
The question is, who's known to have the easiest interview process?
From those big companies.
From the big companies. I mean, I would say that people who have the easiest interview process are probably the worst companies, the ones that you don't want to work for. I don't have a great answer to that. Right? Like, all of the really good companies are going to have pretty rigorous interviews. And I think I would... So I'm not going to answer your question. It's really frustrating. What I'm going to say is you should change your mindset. And instead of thinking about an interview as a hurdle that you have to pass... You should think about it as like an exciting opportunity where you get to meet new people at a company that you're really excited about and have fun, like talking about technology stuff that you should already be excited about. So like really good interviews are ones where you go in and it's stressful and like nerve-wracking, but you're also just like meeting someone who's probably like kind of similar to you and like kind of someone that you'd want to be friends with anyway, and you talk about cool technology stuff and like do brain teasers, which is going to be really fun if you're like in a product mindset. What's the easiest, like who knows, like I've been rejected a number of times at a number of companies. I've had good experiences at other ones. Like, it varies. It depends on your skill set and who you're going to bring with, and there's a lot of variance. Yeah.
The circles method, you have cut priorities, and I'm guessing that you have a pretty common question where you ask how you prioritize problems. So you have ROI estimates, but if you don't really, let's say you know the suite of apps or something, but you don't know what they're looking for, what is exactly?
Okay, so the question is like if you're trying to prioritize different features or different ROIs on different features, like how do you do that, or like how do you figure out what's important or not? So I'd say if you go more into these frameworks, like, the most important thing at starting with the top is what is the goal. So like you can never go into one of these questions without clarifying what is the goal, either by talking to the interview or setting a reasonable assumption of what the goal is, and then from the goal figure out the metrics, the assumptions, and then what features to build, and then you can prioritize the features based on what impact they're going to have on the metrics towards that goal. And if you don't know, then again, you can talk to the interviewer and kind of make a reasonable set of assumptions. Yeah.
Three more questions.
Okay, three more questions.
Could you speak a bit to working at like a larger company like Google, where you know the core product is the search engine, right? And so you can't change that. Which you can make smaller products and work on that, versus like one company just having one small product and you as a product manager people would touch where it goes basically. Like, could you talk a little more about how much control you have over your product?
Okay, so the question is like, how much control do you have over a product and how does that vary from a big company like Google to a smaller company? So most of my experience is at bigger companies, so I can definitely tell you what it's like at Google. On Google, I worked on three different products. Two of them were in search and Android, which are big organizations where you're a tiny little cog in a huge, 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 huge wheel. And the things you're going to be doing are optimizing and tweaking little things, especially as a more junior product manager, which is what I was straight out of college. So as an example, my first feature that I worked on at Google was this thing called Awards Knowledge Panels. What that is if you do a search on Google about an award, and this little box pops up, either on the top of mobile or on the right side of desktop, that says, like, who won the Oscar in 2016 for Best Actor, and like pops up with the answer. That's what I did. I spent a year working on that. It affected 0.02% of search traffic or something. And when it launched, people went nuts. They're like, tens of millions of people are going to be getting this. Like, let's celebrate, get the champagne. And I was kind of like, wow, I just spent a year optimizing 0.02% of search traffic. Like, how winning is my life? So that was my mindset. But on the other hand, it was very structured. I learned a ton of stuff. It was like I had a good manager who taught me what to do, and like I learned the ropes of how things work. So it's a different set of skills, right? Like, it's, do you want to work on a really successful product that has a ton of users and grow the pie, or do you want to have no pie and build the pie and have total control over it, but it's going to be like way more chaos? So in my 3 weeks of startup experience, it's like, okay, what are we building? How do we get one user? How do we find product market fit? Like, what are we even doing? So it's a totally different set of control. You have way, way more control and ownership in a smaller company, but you're trading that off for, like, we have a ton of users, and we're going to have a small little impact on the slice of the pie, but the pie is so big that it's going to impact way more users. So it depends on what you care more about, optimizing things and making that incrementally better, or going from ground zero up, and they both have pros and cons. One is not strictly better than the other. Yeah.
Can you tell the entry level if you learn business interactions or business interfaces while you are working in Google?
My business interactions, like with other companies or internal?
Yeah, internal business.
Okay, so the question is, like, what kind of business interactions did I have? I mean, there's tons of interactions. Like, on a day-to-day basis, I was working very cross-functionally with engineering, design, marketing, PR, legal. You name it. Like, there's a lot of very cross-functional roles, which is really cool, and that's why I like product management. I also worked on an API product, meaning that I was working with third-party developers outside of Google, which I really enjoyed. So on any given day, I would talk to like 10 different startups and companies, and that was really exciting because I got to see what kind of, my users were developers, and I got to see what kind of pain points they had and what kind of products they were building. So I'd always be on phone calls with people outside the company as well. That will totally depend on what product you're working on, whether it's more internally facing or more externally facing. Do user studies, talk to people. When I was on Loon, I would go to rural Peru and talk to like people in these random villages and stuff. Like, it totally depends on what product you're working on, but there's usually a good amount of breadth and diversity. Okay, last question.
Last question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so you talked about how you affected 0.05%. of the Google search traffic, but that's like awesome because that's like millions of people. For me, I'm working at a startup as a PM, and we haven't yet launched or in closed beta. It's a very small group. Or for anyone else who's trying to become a PM and perhaps doing exercises or like thought experiments to build up their portfolio, how do you work the metrics when you don't have sort of large scale successes?
Okay, so the question is, how do you work the metrics when you aren't at a big company and you have, like, you're maybe in closed beta and you don't have a lot of users or maybe no users? So I am about to learn this in my own startup, so I wouldn't say I'm like expertly qualified to answer this question, but in general, always be talking to your users. If you don't have users, talk to people who could be your users. That's what I've been doing. So we haven't launched our product yet. We have like a very early alpha, but every single day, anyone who will listen, I will grab them and start asking about the pain points with personal finance. And I'll start pitching different features and asking them questions about how they would use my product and whether it would be helpful. If you have any users at all, I would be closely tracking the metrics and going and talking to those people in person to figure out, actually watch them use your product, see where they struggle, see what happens, in addition to looking at any logs or metrics you have. And then in general, just harass anyone you can by asking them as many questions as you can. Turn every conversation into a user study until everyone hates you. That's been my approach, but I'm not an expert on this area yet. Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you so much.